This is a Charles Russell Speechlease podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Score, the Charles Russell Speechlease podcast series on legal issues affecting and impacting on the sports world. My name is Darren Bailey. I'm a consultant to Charles Russell Speechlease, and it's my pleasure to be one of the hosts of The Score podcast series. We're going to be today looking at the impact of on sport of the COVID-19 pandemic, in particular as it relates to resumption of training and participation in elite competition, as well as touching on some of the issues in the grassroots side of things. I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by my colleague, Noel Wardle, whose expertise is in the health sector. And he and I hope to be able to sort of get into some of the details underpinning the legal issues affecting the area of resumption. And Noel, welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Darren. Thank you for asking me to join you. It's a pleasure to be speaking to you and to the audience. I'm a partner at Charles Russell Speechlease. I've been at the firm many years now. I've got a dual role in terms of my practice. I've got one hat, which is a healthcare regulatory lawyer. So I act for healthcare practitioners dealing with legal and ethical issues for them. I also represent clients in relation to regulatory crime matters with a particular focus on health and safety issues. And so dealing with return to work generally and return to sport and the legal health and safety and healthcare issues that arise are my particular area of interest.
Many thanks, Noel. I'm delighted you could join us for this session. I mean, it really is being a transformation in the way in which we train for, play and watch sports, something we haven't seen before. But it gives rise to some fascinating legal issues and challenges. And what we're going to look at today is a whole series of the issues that are relevant to this resumption scenario. And firstly, we'll be looking at the overarching legal framework for health and safety in the UK, which ultimately informs the relevant steps, mitigations and risk assessments that need to be undertaken before people can safely return. We'll also take a look at the government guidelines that have been issued to sport in terms of the minimum requirements. We'll take a look at some of the specific dilemmas facing particular sports, notably the contact sports and the team sports. We'll also assess some of the contrasting approaches of relevant medical bodies, such as the World Health Organization, and potentially contrast some of the approaches with national governments, because that could have significant impact on the ability to return to play and what measures may need to be put in place to allow it to happen safely. And finally, we'll take a look at this wider issue of the culture of sport and medicine and whether this crisis may lead to a different way of approaching the whole sports medicine scenario, and whether or not the way in which sports medics operate in the sports sphere will be influenced and profoundly changed by this particular crisis. So fascinating issues to get our teeth into. So can we start, though, Noel, by getting back to some basics? Obviously, sport doesn't have any form of exemption from the law of the land. So in the UK, can you just give us a brief overview of the relevant overarching legal framework that applies to this resumption activity?
Yeah, sure, will do. And apologies for the slight, the short law lecture. I'll try and keep it as light as I possibly can. Health and safety legislation is a complex area of law, as you can imagine.
I'm very confident you can do it.
Thank you. So that's the pressure's on. So the basic framework, the overarching framework for health and safety law in the UK is a piece of legislation which is 40 odd years old now, the Health and Safety at Work Act 1974. And as I say, that sets out the overarching legal framework for protecting health and safety in the UK. It's UK-wide legislation, so applies in all of the nation states. The Act lays down some basic duties on all businesses, and that basic duty is to protect the health, safety and welfare at work of employees, but also those not in their employment. Businesses, of course, under the Act would include sports bodies, clubs and venues. So very much the focus for what we're going to talk about today. And the statutory duty extends beyond, as I say, beyond players, beyond coaches, beyond ground staff and the medical teams who you might consider to be employees. but also include spectators, referees, and those, for example, travelling from other clubs. So those who may be affected by the business, who aren't directly employed by the business. The statutory duties under the Act, they're not absolute statutory duties to protect the health, safety and welfare of individuals. Businesses are only required to do that which is reasonably practicable, which is a term which has been used in worker safety legislation for well over 100 years. It's important to consider what is reasonably practicable, because that requires an assessment of the activity that's taking place, the risk of harm that might arise from that activity, the seriousness of the harm that might arise, and the measures that could be taken to reduce or eliminate that risk. So you'll see from that, Darren, that to assess the risk of harm, the likelihood of harm and the severity of that harm, you're going to need to prepare a risk assessment. And health and safety experts who are familiar with preparing those risk assessments, they'll often use a matrix to assess on one axis, if you like, the risk of harm, and on the other axis, the severity of harm. And the higher up that risk and severity matrix that the activity is placed, the greater the measures that must be taken to protect against those risks. So if you've got a high risk, high severity activity, then you have to do more to protect your workers and others. You have to do more. What is reasonably practicable is a greater burden. Where the risk is low, or the severity of harm is low in those circumstances, you wouldn't have to do as much to overcome that risk. The other thing to mention before we move on is employees also have a duty under the Act. So, for example, football players or sports team players have their own obligations under the Act. They have an obligation to take reasonable care for their own health and safety and for others who may be affected by their acts. And they also have a duty to cooperate as far as they can with the steps that have been taken by the employer to protect health and safety at work. The employees, their duty is not to do what is reasonably practicable. They have a lower burden. They have to take reasonable care. The fact that employees have their own obligations can be used by employers, clubs, or professional bodies to remind those participating in these events that they must do their own bit. They must take their own reasonable care to make sure that they're protecting others and complying with the policies and procedures that are being put in place.
Okay, thanks, Noel. That's very, very helpful to get back to the basic beginning. It's useful to know that that's the starting point. And having spent over 16 years working in, two competitive contact team sports in rugby and football, the complexity of dealing with a virus that really has very unknown characteristics is extremely difficult. And I was very interested to see that the Department for Digital Culture, Media and Sport were putting out some fairly detailed guidance on the return of training and creating a series of stages. Did it surprise you, Noel, the level of complexity and detail in the sports guidance compared perhaps to some of the other economic sectors?
Yes, it is. I mean, the government, a couple of weeks ago, produced a raft of guidance for, can I use the word normal workplaces? construction sites, shops, offices. And that guidance was detailed in return to work and concentrated on making sure that those places of work were COVID-19 secure, which is the buzzword being used in government for return to work across all sectors. So that guidance was detailed, but actually there were lots of common threads to that guidance, keeping people 2 meters apart, having barriers and that kind of thing. Now, of course, the unique challenges that are faced by the sports sector is that pretty much none of that can work in the sports world, in the world of competitive sports, because you can't have, you imagine an office where you can, with some thought and care, keep everybody 2 meters apart and prevent people from touching the same things. You just can't do that in sport. So there's a unique set of challenges which governments, the government and sports bodies are having to face. And it is, you're right to refer to the staged process. There's a 5-stage plan for returning to competitive sports. And the purpose of those plans is to feed in to the risk assessment that I talked about a few moments ago. So we're at stage 2 now of that 5-stage plan. And stage 2 contains an awful lot of detail, but it also misses an awful lot of detail. There's a lot, the guidance from the department sets out what it thinks should happen, but it leaves a lot of the detail of how that is to happen on the individual clubs and sports bodies.
Yeah, thanks, Noel. I think one of the things that struck me about this was that although the government had sought to create quite a sophisticated series of guidance to inform the risk assessment and the mitigation plan, there was no one could be left in any doubt that the guidance didn't constitute legal advice, and it didn't actually allow sports to just simply rely on what the government had been said. It was definitely clear that they needed to seek independent advice from medical practitioners prior to implementing the return to training plan. And I thought that was very loud and clear, and just demonstrates that the responsibility is being pushed back to the individual sports to determine what is fair and reasonable based upon their independent expert medical guidance.
Absolutely. The guidance beginning, Darren, says this is only guidance. It's not legally binding. There's a requirement on all clubs to appoint a COVID-19 officer who must be a physician. And that COVID-19 officer, it has an obligation to carry out that risk assessment and mitigation plan, having regard to the overarching guidance in the stage 2 government plan. And that COVID-19 officer has a lot of work to do to consider how the individual club is going to comply with those requirements.
One of the things that interests me, having worked in a national governing body for the FA and having worked in an international federation for World Rugby, then the International Rugby Board, during my time in international rugby, we were very much focused on looking at receiving advice from international bodies that were able to give a global view that was what was and was not appropriate in the context of, say, concussion. Whereas what I'm seeing at the moment is I'm seeing some potential gap between, say, for example, World Health Organization principles and guidance on what is appropriate and those relating to national governments. And in a contact sport, those are quite important. And the one I'm thinking of in particular, Noel, is this idea of the social distancing and the difference between the 1 meter, which seems to be broadly favoured by the World Health Organization, and the 2 meters, which is a UK government position, as I understand it, and a couple of other territories. And clearly, when you're looking at guidance about returning to contact sport, that's a significant issue. And I wondered how some sports would reconcile that.
So you would expect, and if anybody came and asked me, I would tell them that a UK body club must comply with UK law and guidance. And where there is a difference between UK law and guidance and extraterritorial guidance, for example, from the WHO, the advice would be to follow UK guidance, even where that comes into conflict. I mean, the issue of social distancing is very interesting. It's a key part of COVID-19 secure returning to work, is maintaining that social distancing, which, as you say, Darren, is 2 metres, is the guidance in the UK. Of course, returning to sport necessitates, I probably should say, a breach of that social distancing requirement. And so the whole thrust of the return to sport stage 2 plan is how you mitigate the risks, notwithstanding the fact that you can't keep 2 meters apart. So that 1 meter, 2 meter issue may be something that isn't as relevant in sport as it is in other areas, because competitive sports players team sport players particularly just can't keep that 2 meter. So it doesn't matter whether it's 1 meter or 2 meter, it's just not feasible at all in most sports. I think what will be interesting is if we get to, I think probably stage four, before we get to the possibility of international sport being played, then that will become much more interesting.
We'll definitely be evolving our analysis as to be on the minds of the scientists and the medics is the length of time that people are socially proximate to each other, if I can use that term. And I've been fascinated to look at some of the medical research that seems to have been going on in rugby, where they've identified that there are some risk positions, not unusually perhaps the front row, because of course they're coming into contact with the other front row on a regular basis, and the second row. And they've actually sought to identify the number of minutes in an average series of games that their people are engaged in risk scenario dealing with this COVID-19 crisis. But it goes to demonstrate that people are now having to get down to the real granular detail for their sports to identify where the risk lay.
Yeah, that is absolutely an obligation. The guidance, we're only at stage two, we're only in small cluster training at the moment. But even that makes it clear that face-to-face contact is a particular difficulty as opposed to side-to-side contact where the risks are lower, I believe. And there's nothing more face-to-face and intimate in that sense than a contested scrum.
Absolutely. This has really hit 12 weeks, perhaps, that we're starting to look at fundamental changes to laws of games that would never have been on the table had it not been for this crisis. And another interesting example of taking rugby again is that the upward challenge, the stand-up tackle where people's faces will be closer together, are also likely to be recommended as a guidance that not to take place in territories where there's a high risk of transmissions, because it's potentially seen as obviously a face-to-face direct contact with a more of a risk scenario. So we might see, and that's something where some good might come out of it in a way, because those challenges have always been quite dangerous and the type of challenge where I think most of the injuries have occurred. But again, I doubt the speed of that law adjustment would have been anything like as fast as it's become as a consequence of this crisis.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And then do you ever go back to the old normal after that's happened? And there are lots of, I mean, rugby's an obvious example of a high contact sport, isn't it, where those sorts of changes will be necessitated. But, you know, there's talk about it in other areas, aren't there? Spitting on the football pitch and, you know, those sorts of things, which may become disciplinary matters in a way that they've been tolerated in the past.
Well, absolutely. And just talking about saliva, cricket is now sort of imposing bans on the use of saliva to shine cricket balls. And yet it seems to be suggested that's you can continue to use sweat, which I think, again, is quite a deep scientific analysis as to why one and not the other. But players being players, they're looking at what the consequences of that could mean in terms of their own performance. And I've seen certain fast bowlers expressing real concern that the balance between bat and ball will be transformed because they can no longer swing the ball. It doesn't take too long to get from a situation of having to look at sort of health and safety to wider impacts. And I've even seen, well, one of the solutions to that might be to leave the grass to grow longer on the pitch. So you can always see the players' focus is on getting back to competition, which is a great thing, but a slightly strange one at the same time.
Yes, and it's interesting because I was reading about that, the ball issue in cricket, that sweat and saliva may not be used, so neither may be permitted. And it's difficult. This really highlights the difficulty facing all professional sports is if you're going to carry out that risk assessment, if you're going to assess the risk of harm and the severity of harm, the likelihood of harm, if you're going to carry out that risk assessment matrix, you need to have some pretty good information about the risk of harm and the severity of the harm. And of course, to an extent, a lot of those decisions are being made and having to be made without really that scientific evidence. And so if you're a sports body or a club and you're assessing, can I do this X activity, say, well, how can I assess the risk of harm out of that when I don't know how easily COVID-19 is transmitted out on a football pitch in the rain, you know, in October, where two players are within 10 centimetres of each other. I don't have that information. So how am I going to assess the risk of harm? And your point about the ball in cricket is exactly that point, isn't it? Yeah, how can you assess the risk of harm between saliva and sweat? Are they the same? You know, I think probably nobody really knows.
Absolutely. And I think in a way, what that does is it leads on to the next issue, which is, in reality, there are going to have to be some big calls made by the medical profession as to what is safe and what is outside of that assessment. And for me, this is a potentially real significant moment for the medical profession and its relationship within sport. Now, it's always been a very tricky place for medics to operate because of the, you know, the perceived conflicts of interest when players want to return quickly to get back on the field, the short-term risk management along with the longer-term implications of a particular return to play decision, and maybe pressures from employers or owners or fans in order to get back, or agents and intermediaries. I can see there being a really important shift in the culture as it relates to sports medicine, and whether or not now, the because of the critical assessments that these individuals will be making, that there may well be a sort of a shift in the culture that operates around the medical profession in sport. And we may see much more autonomy across the medical profession as a result of the importance and the difficulty of the assessments they're having to make. Do you see that as a potential trend, Noel?
I do, yeah. I mean, we talked a little earlier about the risk assessments having to be regularly reassessed via that named COVID-19 officer. And you remember I mentioned that COVID-19 officer must be a physician, a doctor. And the guidance specifically requires them to maintain familiarity with the emerging evidence relating to COVID-19 pathology. So the doctors really are, the COVID-19 officer, which will be the doctor, really does have a central role to play in assessing the safety of particular activities and return to sport. Now, doctors are very familiar with dealing with conflicts of interest. They arise all the time. They arise commonly in the NHS. Decisions made about treatment options, including, you know, having regard to scarce NHS resources. So this is nothing new for the medical profession. It does give medics a much greater responsibility and a much greater role to play in saying yes or no to a particular activity. And it's really important that medics are given the autonomy and the authority and the space to make those important decisions, and that those decisions are respected by the clubs and the teams. So yes, I do see that. I do see that shift. It's a big role for the medics.
Certainly one that I perceive that it is going to really result in a change of the way in which they do their day-to-day jobs, not just in the context of the return to play and the resumption of play, but I apprehend over the next period of time, issues relating to public health, welfare are going to be at the top end of the agenda for sport, whether it's in relation to elite sport. And we haven't really had time to touch on the difficulty of participatory sport at the lower levels, the grassroots, which really is something that's going to be a very hard thing to see coming back in the close proximity of time. But I do think one of the things that I'm delighted about is that we do have access to people like yourself with your expertise, because, you know, as a sports team, it's increasingly important for us to provide the added value of that's required for the sports challenges right now. So to combine our sports team with the public health team to deliver advice in this very tricky and rapidly evolving area, hopefully will provide clients and our other people that we work with a great sense of comfort that we really do know what we're doing in this space, and we can help them navigate through what is probably an unprecedented period of sport, and one that it can be done, but it's just going to have to take some very resolute focus and expertise in order to help people get through these tricky times. So Noel, thank you very much indeed for providing such an excellent and non-dull overview of the relevant legal and scenario and framework in this area. I hope those listening have enjoyed our initial foray into the resumption of sport. And we will be back to look at some of the other wider implications resulting from resumption in the context of insurance and employment frameworks over the coming weeks. So thank you very much for listening.
This is a Charles Russell Speechlease podcast.